Robert Thompson is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Stay with us as we discuss capital punishment and witness the legal homicide of Robert Thompson in Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Professor Dennis Longmire, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special guest, State Representative Harold Dutton, a member of the House Corrections Committee and proponent of legislation to ban the death penalty for non-killers convicted under the Texas Law of Parties. The Execution Watch begins. Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people?
Good evening, this is Ray Hill. You're listening to radio station KPFT Houston HD2 channel, or you're listening by the World Wide Web on executionwatch.org. You can get there and tell your friends to get there through kpft.org or theprisonshow.org. This tonight is November the 19th, 2009. The execution process begins about 6 o'clock. We're standing by for word from Rick Halpern, a professor Dennis Longmire, a professor from Sam Houston State University in the Criminal Justice Department. He reports from the vigil outside the death chamber, and we will have him as soon as Elizabeth can line him up on the phone. Out with me tonight, of course, Jim Skelton, our own legal analyst, who's going to tell us the story of this case, what happened, when it happened, who was involved in what happened, and then that will be followed by a discussion of the legal history of the case, what happened in the trial and the appeals, and then we will go from there to talk with Harold Dutton. Harold Dutton is a state representative from North Houston who proposed legislation to eliminate the execution of people under the law of parties when one is not a shooter. What do you do? And you will find in the course of tonight's discussion that this case complicates that principle pretty severely. And what do you do in this situation as with others? But we've got Dennis Longmire coming up. I'm ready when you are. Dennis, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me, Ray?
I can hear you well. Go ahead.
Well, we are on the corner, and about 3 minutes ago, the witnesses for the condemned went in. About 4 minutes before that, the witnesses for the media had gone in. We thought that maybe there were no witnesses for tonight's victim, but apparently there are. So we now know the governor has lived up to his reputation, and the execution will go forward, apparently.
Yeah, Alan Turner posted it on the Houston Chronicle just about 20 minutes ago that the governor had rejected and that the proceeding would go tonight. Dennis, yeah. How many folks are there?
There are about seven of us on the corner. Nobody at all connected with Robert Thompson, and so it's just a group of us regular vigilers, I guess you would call us. We have a new member of the group who's a student up at Sam Houston State University and involved in the NAACP active group there.
Okay.
And so he was here last night as well.
Well, Dennis, you teach criminal justice at the Sam Houston University there in Huntsville. Does the young man from the NAACP want to talk to us?
He's not young, but I'll certainly ask him if he'd
okay.
like to speak to you. Hold on 1 second.
Well, that was a value judgment.
I'm on the line with the radio station down in Houston, and they would love to hear from you if you'd like to talk with them. They're at KPFT. Hold on 1 second. I
thank you.
I told you
they're
associated with NAACP University.
Yes, I'm Harry Fred Scott.
Okay. Fred Scott? Is that your name?
Harry Fred Scott.
Okay, Harry Fred. Tell us about the organization of NAACP on campus there in Huntsville.
Probably one of the more aggressive college chapters in Texas. And we have 100 or so members, right at 200 members.
Mercy.
Yes.
You're doing all the good there. You come down to join Dennis and the other vigilants there outside the death chamber when there's an execution?
Yes, but I live on campus. I'm a full-time student.
Okay, well, we're glad to have you with us tonight. Give our regards to the group and tell them how they can hear the archive of tonight's show.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you, sir. You can go to executionwatch.org, and tonight's show will be archived there. Can you put Dennis back on?
I'm placing Dennis on at this moment.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, Ray,
Dennis,
okay.
We're going to let you go and get us back in touch if anything happens.
I sure will.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was Professor Dennis Longmire of Sam Houston State University and Harry Fred Scott in the student chapter at Sam Houston State University of the NAACP, two vigilants outside the death chamber. Jim.
Yes.
Tell us about this case.
What happened? Robert Lee Thompson was a 21-year-old man when this happened. He and a kid named Sammy Butler had done a series of robberies. In fact, this was the third, when they killed this man was killed, this was the third robbery killing they had done in a 24-hour period.
Mercy.
And what he said later on, he claimed that God had told him to watch out for Middle Eastern people and Oriental people. They were rude and bad to black people, and he was an African-American. And what happened on this occasion, it was apparently a fairly crowded store. They go into a convenience store. Of course, the convenience store is operated by a couple of Middle Eastern guys. And Thompson went in with a .25 caliber pistol. And the other guy, Sammy Butler, had a .38 pistol. And what happened, he pulled the gun, ordered the cashier to open the cash drawer. When the cashier didn't move fast enough, he shot him in the stomach.
Hmm.
And about this point, the cashier's cousin ran to the back of the store, and Thompson shot at him, as did Sammy Butler. And then Sammy Butler threatened to shoot some more. They didn't hit the cousin that ran to the back of the store. And they threatened to shoot some more people inside the store. At that point, the cashier was on the ground, and then Thompson shot him three more times in the abdomen with a .25 caliber. Then he made him get up and open the cash drawer, and he took all the money out of the cash drawer. Then began to beat him to the head of the pistol in the cash drawer, knocked him down again, put the gun to the cashier's neck and pulled the trigger, but he was out of bullets. That's the only thing that probably saved his life. He had no more bullets left. So he fled from the store. As he fled, Butler grabbed a bunch of lottery tickets. And they ran out in the parking lot and jumped in the car. And the same cousin of the cashier that ran to the back of the store kept running out, I presume, to get the license plate number. And what I met then when Butler with the .38 shot two times and hit the cousin of the cashier in the chest and killed him. So what happened, the man shot by Thompson survived, but the person shot by Thompson's co-defendant survived. It was the one that was killed. He was killed as he ran from the store. And Thompson ended up getting the death penalty. He was tried first. And then about 6 months after Thompson was tried, they tried Butler on a capital murder case. And interesting enough, the jury found Butler guilty of what we call felony murder, which means it's not a capital crime, and gave him a life sentence. And I think the reasoning for that was when Thompson was first arrested, he told the police that Butler shot at the window. The guy kept coming out of the store, and he said he shot out the window to warn him and didn't intend to kill. And I'm assuming that's what the jury went out on in Butler's trial, that he didn't have the intent to kill. He was shooting at the window to warn him and just, I presume, unlucky shot and killed the cousin of the cashier. So he was found guilty of capital murder. And of course, that created the appellate issues that later came up, that he was convicted as a party. Now, to understand this, you've got to understand how it was submitted to the jury. And this is one of those things we've argued about being terribly unfair the way this issue is submitted. It's submitted three ways. Number one, you can find Thompson guilty if he was the one that committed the murder. Or you can find him guilty if he aided, encouraged, or assisted Butler to commit the murder. Both those require him to have specific intent to kill.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a third way they submitted to the jury. If you find they entered into a conspiracy, and the conspiracy to rob with Butler, in other words, Thompson and Butler into a conspiracy to rob, and when they entered into the conspiracy, was it foreseeable that somebody was going to be killed? Was that a foreseeable event, something you could have anticipated? Then he could also be found guilty of capital murder. Because the way it works, let's say you and I conspire to rob a store.
Okay.
And we join a conspiracy, and our intent is to do the robbery.
Mm-hmm.
We go into the store, and you kill somebody because we join a conspiracy. And if that killing's in furtherance of the conspiracy, I can be held responsible for that murder. And I can be executed under the law if it could have been anticipated on my part that a murder would have been committed when we made the conspiracy. That doesn't require an intent to kill. It requires an intent to commit the conspiracy of robbery. So, see, the third way it's submitted to the jury is if he had an intent to conspire with Butler to commit a robbery and should have anticipated that Butler would have killed somebody, he could also be found guilty of capital murder. That's where the way the three theories were submitted.
And this was not the only murder this weekend.
No, he had killed. As a matter of fact, there were three pending capital murder cases pending at the time of all of them robberies, and most of them Middle Eastern Oriental clerks and stores.
And did those happen before this robbery?
Before this one.
Before this robbery. So if you were along on any of the other attempts to rob, then the chances are you might have had some responsibility or culpability.
Absolutely. But I don't know the facts of those other cases, whether Butler Thompson was the one who was the actual killer in those cases or whether Butler was. I got the impression Thompson had been the trigger man in most of these cases because they tried him first.
Well, the other question I have, I mean, we have a man that shot three or four times with a 25 caliber pistol. And he's getting up and opening cash register drawer.
I mean, well, what is with that? They're going to shoot you again if you don't get up. You've got inspiration to get off the floor. I mean, I'm telling you. At 25, you know, a guy shot you once in the stomach, and he wants you to get up. You're going to probably get up. And then he shoots him three times when he's on the floor after he gets up.
Is a 25 not as lethal as a 38?
Oh, no.
Tell me about this.
There have been instances. In fact, when Dr. Juhemchuk was alive, I used to go to the morgue a lot and see him. And there was a case that he didn't have the case we were talking about. A guy got shot between the eyes at 22 and didn't even break the skin. Made a knot on his head, kind of gave him a headache. Had a lump on his head and gave him a little bruise, but didn't break the skin. And a 25 caliber is not really powerful. It's barely above a 22. And if there's no hollow points, and now you can shoot somebody a bunch of times with a 25 caliber and they'll survive.
Well, that struck me as a little strange, but and I don't know anything about guns.
You know those little tiny Berettas? You see this little tiny Beretta pistol? Pistols that a lot of strange people carry, they're pretty worthless, and they like you can shoot somebody with them unless you happen to hit a vital organ. You're going to survive it fine.
Okay, that sounds strange.
And so, of course, the other guy had a 38, and getting hit with the 38 is a whole lot different. It's kind of like getting bit by, you know, a centipede as opposed to a scorpion. You know, it's a lot of difference. Because the other guy shot with a 38.
38, and that was a more lethal weapon.
Right.
Anything about the trial or the appeals that's...
The trial, I read the opinions on the appeal and what happened. There was some evidence submitted about his tragic childhood, so they admitted what they call a penury issue and what they said. They also gave to the jury what they call an anti-parties charge. And that anti-parties charge said they asked, could he have anticipated, if he didn't do the killing, could he have anticipated, or should have anticipated, that Butler did the killing? And it's kind of hard not to anticipate that because he was shooting everybody in the store as well as Thompson was. And the fact that, and then the jury found out that he had been charged with three more capital murders, and I think they said, forget all this stuff, flush it. And I think that's what really probably did more damage than anything.
Is that introducible in this case?
Absolutely. Because remember the three issues that are submitted in a capital murder case. Will a person be a danger to the future? Is there a likelihood he'll commit future acts of violence that would threaten society? It's got to be acts of violence. But here you've got a guy that shot and killed three people in a 24-hour period and killed another person earlier or been involved in it. You have three capital murders pending. That is relevant for the jury to know about to determine whether or not he'd be a future danger, and therefore it's relevant. It's called an unadjudicated offense. And what the only protection they give you in these cases like this on punishment, the jury's instructed they got to believe beyond a reasonable doubt that he's guilty of the unadjudicated offenses before they can consider them. But when you introduce that evidence of three more capital murder cases, shooting this clerk, and then shooting him in the stomach and then shooting him on the floor, then trying
it's
to
like
kill him.
Like a snowball going downhill.
Trying to shoot him in the neck, and the reason he didn't kill him is because he's out of bullets, so he shot at everybody else. So it's, you know, it's almost impossible, it's with any type of jury, to get them to believe that he didn't anticipate somebody could have been killed because of his conduct. Because he knows both of them are armed when they go in.
So when we talk about law of parties cases, this is one that is mitigated by other factors, is that fair analysis?
It's pretty much true. Because, see, in this case, this wasn't the thing of a guy just happened to standing around helping somebody kind of innocent. This was a guy that kind of planned robberies, had killed a bunch of people before, went in and tried to kill the clerk. The only reason he didn't kill the clerk, he was out of bullets and wasn't a good shot. That's the only reason the clerk survived. He even shoots earlier at the man that ends up being dead, tries to shoot him. And the only thing that might have saved him, and the two big issues on appeal was, and what he tried to argue, well, if I'm held as a party to a crime, and the major participator was the shooter, how can I be found guilty of capital murder if I'm a party to a non-capital case? That was the argument made on appeal. Plus, he argued also his lawyer was ineffective for not requesting a felony murder, lesser-included offense felony murder charge in his trial. Those are the two things he argued on appeal. And the unfortunate thing is the law, and see, he was convicted on the law of parties plus the law of conspiracy. It wasn't just the law of parties. And what makes that terribly unfair? There's three ways the issues are submitted, three of them. Did he do the killing? Number one. If not, did he encourage Butler to do the killing? Number two. Did he join a conspiracy with Butler to rob and should have anticipated after he joined the conspiracy somebody would be killed in furtherance of the conspiracy? He could be convicted on either of those three, but the jury doesn't have to designate which of the three they found him guilty of. You may have two believing that it's a party theory. The rest of them believe it's a conspiracy theory because there's a general verdict submitted. And we've argued for years this makes for a non-unanimous verdict because we don't know how the jury voted. Were they voted on the conspiracy theory or they voted on the parties theory?
From a criminal defense lawyer, you're saying that there is a reasonable argument that there is no way of knowing that the jury really agreed on the theory of the case.
That's right. Which is the 3-1? And we've always argued you should have separate indictments, separate verdicts. But they have flushed that argument over and over again. And they only have one general verdict, guilty or not guilty, under either of all three of the three theories. Because there's no question he was not the shooter.
Yeah.
Everybody agrees with that. So the question was, did he encourage Butler to do the shooting? If not, did he join a conspiracy with Butler to rob? It's kind of hard to say he didn't join that conspiracy, went in the store together with guns. And that what the defense lawyer argued primarily throughout trial, he did not anticipate Butler shooting that clerk when he came out of the store because they were in the process of leaving. And he was shooting at the window, according to what Thompson told the police, to make the clerk go back in the store and more or less accidentally hits the clerk. So that was that's how the defense rested their case
That Butler got convicted of a non-capital murder.
Absolutely. He was tried for capital murder, but
he got convicted of something. And then there's no way to get the spade under the rock and go back?
Because the statutes covering the law of parties and what they call accomplice liability. See, what we focus in on is the intent when the killing you're being tried for is on trial. It's no defense that the other parties got less or even if they were acquitted. There have been instances where people have been acquitted who did the primary act, and the accomplice of the one that contributed to that got convicted, and they say that is no defense. And so they've done that over and over again, and the statute specifically says that's not a defense because what you should concentrate on is whether or not you had the intent at the time the killing you're being tried for, and the intent to assist somebody else, or the intent to join a conspiracy and anticipated a murder would have resulted if you committed the murder in furtherance of the conspiracy.
Why isn't that considered pretty sloppy stuff?
It is pretty sloppy. I mean, and I think the major reason for this case is, had this been just one robbery murder, it might have worked. But the problem is, they've often said bad facts make bad law.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, he got no relief from anybody, primarily because he was involved in so many murders. And that made it especially egregious. And like I say, they gave what they call a Penry mitigation instruction because of his tragic background. That didn't work. And so the whole focus of the defense at trial was, that he did not anticipate the clerk running out of the store.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't anticipate that.
Yeah.
And didn't anticipate that Butler would shoot at the clerk when he came out of the store. And it's a question of fact whether Butler was shooting at the window or shooting at the clerk. He didn't kill the window, he killed the clerk.
Yeah.
That was a problem.
And these were all aired under appeals, and
yeah.
Nobody took umbrage?
No. And Kathy Cochran, who's one of the better judges on the Court of Criminal Appeals, wrote the opinion on the writ, because this was an issue on direct appeal, because the trial didn't come up until 6 months later where Butler got a less than capital murder case. This is all aired out during the post-conviction writ in the state courts. And Kathy Cochran, who's one of the more intellectual judges, one of the better judges up there, is the one that wrote the opinion. No dissenting opinions, because the law is pretty clear that the way the conspiracy law is written, that if the primary actor, what happens to him is of no consequence in the trial of one of the people that assisted the primary actor. The law, in fact, the statute says that. It's not a defense.
Can you tell from looking at the appellate work that Mr. Thompson was well represented?
I think so. I mean, when you get that set of facts, I think the law, in fact, one of the things he argued that the trial lawyer was ineffective for not requesting a felony murder charge. But Kathy Cochran pretty well pointed out he was never entitled to a lesser included defense of capital murder charge. You have somebody coming in, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hello, who is this? Is this Dennis?
Yes, this is Ray. Your listening audience can rest peaceful tonight because there's going to be less murder because we killed another murderer.
Okay, well, this
is... have all come out, and
yeah.
I find it very hard to believe, but it's true. We actually went forward with the execution, and... I am kind of flat-footed on this. I'm very surprised.
It is now 6:22, and in less than 20 minutes, the whole process was completed because it takes a few minutes for people to get from the death chamber to the street.
Correct.
Dennis, we appreciate your being with us. You have any comments?
Like I said, I am absolutely baffled that the governor didn't listen to the Board of Pardons and Paroles. Several of the people on the corner basically suggested that the Board of Pardons and Paroles is useless in instances specifically related to the death penalty, and we unfortunately can't even have much hope that they can have an influence today.
There are 7 members of the Board of Pardons and Paroles. There are more commissioners than that, but the actual board members are 7. 5 of them voted to grant clemency in this case. 2 of them were opposed.
Correct. That's my understanding. I don't know. I don't know what. I haven't heard anything at all about how Perry has justified or explained it, if he has even said anything. I'm anxious to hear what he says. My suspicion is, and this was actually shared to me by Ward Luck and one of the other people who is just here, who's left. He speculates that Perry will say that he must have spoken with the family members of the victim and they wanted it to go forward or something.
Well, I have a co-conspirator here in the studio with me who suggested that the difference between this and the other case where...
K. Bailey Hutchins.
Was an election year and K. Bailey Hutchins living at his heels.
Well, I hate to think that it's that crass, but you're probably right.
I don't think there is any limit to the ability of the governor of Texas being crass.
I think that you're right.
Thank you, Dennis. We appreciate it. Give our regards to the other vigilants.
Shall do. Thank you again for everything you do.
Thank you, sir. And that was Professor Dennis Longmire, who is in Huntsville outside the death chamber. It is the sad duty of Execution Watch staff now to call David Atwood, who is here in Houston at a vigil, I believe, near the Martel Convent over on OST and Holcomb Boulevard, and tell him that it's time for the sisters and he to go home because the execution is completed. We have responsibilities here to do that, and we hope that you that are listening live tonight and those of you who are hearing this on the archive will understand that it is not one of my more pleasant things to do is to come in here and cover executions. Elizabeth and I had a discussion about the fact that we thought generally Texas media were ignoring execution. It was so routine, and at that time we were getting maybe one or two column inches in the back of the state and local section. Okay, we're going to have Dave Atwood on. And Dave, are you there?
I'm here, Ray.
Where are you?
Again, we're out at the corner of Alameda and Holcomb.
Okay, Alameda and Holcomb. And it is our sad responsibility to tell you that the process is complete. Mr. Thomas Thompson, Robert Thompson, approximately 6:20 or shortly before that, died of lethal injection, a homicide officially sanctioned by the state.
Yep. Another execution for Texas.
Dave, we've been discussing the fact that five of the seven parole board members recommended clemency in this case.
Yeah.
And two opposed it. And I don't think there's any way to sort out which of the five and which who were the two. But your thoughts along those lines?
Well, to me, what it shows is that there are some more reasonable people on the parole board than there are in the governor's mansion. You know, I think that they're a very conservative group of people, and they're appointed by the governor, so they're not going to get on that parole board unless they are, you know, basically in tune with his politics, I don't think. But, you know, to me this shows that at times they look at a case and they see that it doesn't make sense to execute this person. Maybe he'll be in prison for a long time, but execution doesn't seem right. And so very rarely they will recommend something different. It's very rare when they do it.
Although there were some mitigating circumstances, that this is not as clear a law party case as, go get Harold on the phone. This is not as clear a party's case as was the Kenneth Foster case.
Yeah.
Because Mr. Thompson had done some shooting and actually had shot the clerk a couple of times prior to the clerk's cousin getting shot by his co-conspirator. But still, law of parties cases, and we're fixing to have Harold Dutton on to talk about eliminating executions in the case of law of parties cases.
And well, it seems like it would make sense to do that, to restrict those. I mean, if it's supposedly for the worst of the worst, and I mean, I can see where people would argue for the law of parties if you've got somebody who, you know, conspired, so to speak, and took, maybe they didn't pull the trigger, but they really conspired to eliminate somebody, to kill somebody. Maybe they could make a case for law of parties in those circumstances. But a lot of these cases, something happened and the person was not, you know, there wasn't a thought-out process to kill somebody. And but it happened, and it seems like in those cases where the death penalty would not be appropriate for the person that did not actually do the killing. But, you know, I think these fine points don't make a big difference, quite frankly, to Governor Perry. I think he will at any time look for a way to have an execution be carried out, and just extremely rare that he'd ever do anything different. And I think politics enters into it to a certain extent, although personally I think it would have been smarter for him politically to let this to commute this sentence to life. But you know, he's appealing to his far right wing supporters, and that's what they want, and that's what he wants. And you know, and so here we go with another execution. I just think not much is going to change in this state until the politics of the state changes tremendously. We get new people in power who have a better sense of the value of human life, and or you know, the Supreme Court does something that stops it. But with people like Perry and the people that support him on the far right, then we're just going to have this continue. It's not going to stop until...
Dave, how do people get in touch with the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty?
Best way is to go to our website, which is tcadp.org, tcadp.org. And we have a lot of good information on there, so on the executions that are scheduled, but also on a whole bunch of other stuff that we're doing.
Dave, we appreciate that, and give our regards to your fellow vigilants there, and I'm afraid we have another one of these appointments next week.
No. Okay. Thanks, Ray.
Thank you, Dave.
Okay.
That's Dave Atwood of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. As of now, we can report that Robert Lee Thompson has been executed in the death of Mansour by Rahim Mohammed, and who was a cousin to a clerk of a convenience store. And all of that came to a head here in Houston. The execution was not far from here in Huntsville. Jim, you got anything to add to what we have? We're going to get Harold Dutton in here shortly.
The reason, you know, I mentioned the fact that I think it's political, if you recall, going back in history, Clinton, who somebody once said was the best Republican president we've ever had, mm-hmm. When he was governor of Arkansas, he was in a contested race. And there was a guy that everybody wanted pardon or get clemency for, is kind of retarded, mm-hmm. and he refused to do it, and the guy was executed. He's always been real sensitive about
that. But didn't
he
come off the campaign trail and return to Arkansas while he was actually running for president?
Well, I think so.
To sign a death warrant.
That's right, and he's really been real defensive about that. And I think in this particular case, when I first heard that the board had voted 5-2, I was never convinced that Perry would ever follow the board's recommendation. He does the same thing he always does. He hides behind the fact that this case has been reviewed by all of our courts, by all of our federal courts, and they've all reviewed everything. Well, that isn't exactly the way the appellate process works, but the general public doesn't know that. Because truthfully, the two major appeals that are considered, and the federal court's pretty well stuck with what those courts rule, is a direct appeal after a case is tried, and then the state post-conviction writ. Because what happens, the federal court, when they accept a case, they don't review all the facts again. They ask this question: was the decision by the state courts unreasonable in light of Supreme Court law? They may disagree with what the Texas courts have done. But if it's not an unreasonable application of federal law, they're going to affirm it. So
it's it's not entirely unusual for us to get a statement from Antonin Scalia that the Supreme Court has never really been concerned about the issue of innocence. It's a matter of the manner of trial.
Well, it's whether or not the state court made a reasonable application of current law. And they may, I could say they may disagree with the outcome, but you don't get that thorough. The only time you have a thorough review of any type of capital case is on the direct appeal and on the state post-conviction writ. The federal stuff is just more or less overlooking somebody to see if they did it right. And they don't review all the facts again. In fact, they review very few of the facts. So there's not that most. I think the general public think that a review, a real thorough review by a whole series of courts, that simply is not true. And if you have an election year like this, I think there's any way in the world that Perry would ever grant a stay. Plus, you've got the fact, and you can't escape this, that this was a bad case. I mean, the facts of this case are bad. The only reason there weren't two clerks dead is Thompson ran out of bullets.
Yeah.
And then this is the fourth capital murder committed in the space of time of clerks, two within 24 hours of this one. And so those facts make it. In fact, if you will read the Chronicle website, when people write in to write comments, I read the article when the Board of Pardons and Parole voted 5-2 to commute. Everybody on there, everybody that wrote in, kill him, get the needle sharp, kill more. Why don't we kill the other guy?
Yeah, well, as you know, who's mostly on those Chronicle blogs?
This wasn't a blog. These are letters.
I understand. People write following each article,
right.
Then people write.
I have comments,
on,
right?
And most of those are cops.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're bored. They're on their paycheck. Ain't nothing going on. They ain't no robbers to go check. So they sit there and. and answer Chronicle articles all the time. It took me a while to figure that out.
But there's nobody at all sympathetic with the board. Excuse me.
All right. I believe we have Harold Dutton. Harold?
Yes, sir.
State Representative Harold Dutton, the Honorable. We're glad to have you on Execution Watch. We are sorry to announce that the man has been executed tonight.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. It's not a happy time for me, but I appreciate the opportunity to be on here.
Well, your thoughts on the occasion. The governor had ample advice to grant some kind of clemency. He just didn't choose to do that.
Yeah, I wrote a letter along with my colleague, Terry Hodge. We sent a letter to both the Rissy Owens and the board members, and I was pleased by their action. I think they voted 5-2 to recommend clemency to the governor. And but then when I read the governor's press release, I was absolutely floored because it just begs the question of whether or not the governor really believes that justice was served in this case, and I don't believe it was.
Well, you and Representative Hodge had some legislative input during the session about bringing some changes in the law as it relates to law party cases. Can you explain that to us?
Well, yeah. I mean, let me explain to you what we did. Under the way Texas law works now, a person to be charged with a murder, has to be an intentional act. It has to be an intentional killing. Now, there are exceptions to that. One exception is if you happen to be engaging in another felony and a death results. That means that you can be engaging in another felony, and even if the person is killed accidentally, you could still be charged with murder in Texas. Well, the law parties takes that one step further and says that if you happen to be with this person and you aided them, but that person actually did the killing, but you happen to be along for the ride, you can now also be charged with capital murder. And so what Ms. Hodge and I did during this past session is we were trying to fix it so that you would have a better outcome in terms of two instances. One is, which the governor agreed with, he said, well, I think you ought to have separate trials. My argument, though, was that even if you have separate trials, you can end up with a result that just begs the question of whether or not justice prevailed. And that is exactly the situation we had here with Mr. Thompson, because the shooter in his case, who was in a separate trial, the shooter got life.
Not even capital life. He got felony life.
And he got felony life, yeah. And then for Mr. Thompson, he gets the death penalty. Well, what's the difference? The only difference could possibly be perhaps the makeup of the jury, the kind of lawyer he had. It's my understanding there were several deficiencies that were pointed out on the lawyer's conduct for Mr. Thompson. And so it just creates a problem for me.
Representative,
I'd like to do away with this law parties.
Representative, you are a lawyer.
Yes.
And do you have a practice criminal law?
Yes.
Well, I mean, as a criminal lawyer and you were presented with this, do you think you would have handled this case differently from the lawyers that were representing Mr. Thompson?
Well, let me put it this way. I think that the lawyers, as I understand it, and I have not read through the whole transcript, I will admit.
Okay.
But what's been represented to me is that the lawyers for Mr. Thompson failed to bring anybody in to testify about Mr. Thompson's background, which obviously played a key role, particularly since he was not the shooter. Nobody came in to testify about his upbringing, about his past, about things that might have been persuasive enough to cause him to lead the kind of life he had chosen to lead. None of that kind of evidence was ever brought forth. And so as a lawyer, I think you have a duty to make sure that you bring all the evidence that you possibly can, particularly to a trial where the person is facing death.
Well,
I can't conceive of where you wouldn't just, you know, try to pile on every evidence, every piece of evidence that you could in a case like this. And so,
a little less than 2 years ago, the governor was also petitioned or faced a petition from the parole board in the Kenneth Foster case.
Yes, Terry Hodge and I wrote a letter in regards to that case. That's why I felt a little bit optimistic. As I told Terry, I felt optimistic that the governor would look at this favorably in terms of Mr. Thompson, because we've done the same thing in Kenneth Foster's case. Now, the governor did say at the time, though, that his real problem with the Kenneth Foster case was the fact that Mr. Foster and the co-defendant had been tried together.
Uh-huh.
They were not tried separately, and so that was what the governor kept saying, and that's why I kept arguing with him that you could still have a rather non-justice outcome, even though you had separate trials, particularly where the person who actually did the killing received one punishment and the other party received a greater punishment. As I said to the governor, I said, well, you could have a situation where two guys going to commit a robbery, one says, well, no, I want to be the shooter because I'll get a lesser penalty than if I'm driving the vehicle. That would be absurd. And so that's what the law seems to permit now, and that's why we were trying to change it during this last legislative session.
Representative Harold Dutton, number one, I want to compliment you on your work about restoration of citizenships for former felons.
Absolutely. That's another law that needs to be changed. Do you know that the way the law works now, if you were convicted in another country, in another state, you can petition to get your rights restored. But if you were convicted in Texas, you're basically out of luck.
Wait a minute. I vote in every election.
Oh, I know, but I'm talking about your full rights restored.
We got the voting thing handled.
We got the voting thing, but you can't run for office, for example.
Well, you know, I did that several times, and nobody raised that in my attempts. It wasn't until civil rights guy down in Galveston run that created a body of law which struck me as being kind of racist.
Well, I think it is, too. I thought it was, too. I thought it should have been done differently. But, again, that was that's one of those things that we'll continue to try to work on to see if we can't bring some sanity to the law. I mean, when the law produces an outcome where a shooter, the person who actually killed somebody, can get a lesser punishment than the other party, something's wrong with the law. And so I hope that somebody will begin to join me and Terry Hodge in trying to fix this. And I hope the governor's office seeks to fix it. I really don't understand why the governor didn't view this case the way I view it.
You have some help on the Senate side in this legislation, don't you?
Well, we're working, and we're still working on that, too.
Okay. And you will be back at the wheel come January?
Yes, we'll be back at the wheel trying to make sure that we bring some sanity to the law in Texas.
I mean January of 11.
Yeah, not this January.
Not this one.
But I appreciate all you all's help, too, and I appreciate you all getting the message out in many cases to people. I just think it's a sad day in Texas when we allow the law to have the outcome that it had today.
Representative, give our love and regards to Representative Hodge.
I will. I will call her as soon as I hang up and tell her that we did what we could. I know her heart is pretty heavy right now, too, like mine is.
And we booked up the next one. I'm afraid we have this program again next week unless there is a stay in that case.
Give me a shout-out, and we'll do what we can.
It's just before Thanksgiving.
I think it's just before Thanksgiving.
December the 3rd.
Yeah.
Is when we're
just
gonna,
after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But thank you very much, sir, and stand by. We may be giving you another call.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. That was Representative Harold Dutton, a representative from a district in North Houston, It's a relatively safe district for Representative Dutton, and he has held that seat for a good many years. And his colleague Sinfronia Thompson, with an adjoining district, is now the dean of the Texas House. And so, Jim, this is a different case.
Well, one thing I want to mention, the direct appeal wasn't published, only the writ was, so I didn't get to read the direct appeal, what was presented, but there was some evidence presented at punishment about the guy's background, because they submitted a penry charge. And the only time you ever get a penry charge, if there's been some, and the way the penry charge works is there a circumstance or some circumstances that warrant the person getting a life sentence rather than death because of his circumstance of his childhood? So some testimony was presented at punishment. They wouldn't have got that jury instruction. Now, how extensive it was, I don't know. But see, all of that, I think, again, was over. What overcame all of that, I don't care what you would have done, when the jury realized he was a trigger man in two additional robbery murders. Now, that's what did not, the butler, the co-defendant, was not the trigger man of the other ones. This guy was a trigger man.
Yeah.
And I think that pretty well over, this would wipe out any type of mitigating evidence you could present. Because truthfully, I think what the lawyers for Butler did, I think they rode the same theory that this defense lawyer rode, is that Butler didn't intentionally kill the clerk. He didn't anticipate the person running out. And it was the very same thing argued in Butler's case. I mean, the very same thing argued in Thompson's case. Of course, it didn't work.
Yeah.
And they don't think the reason. In fact, even Kathy Cochran said in the opinion, the reason it didn't work probably was because of the additional robbery murders that he had committed shortly before this one. And I think what they didn't have in the second trial, they didn't have this Butler being the trigger man in other robbery killings. And I think the same thing he argued here worked for them.
Do appellate judges frequently write in their opinion this kind of detail?
Kathy Cochran does.
What is the difference? I mean, is there different levels of information available in an opinion depending on who writes it?
Well, here's the way it works, Ray. The truth of the matter is we think that these judges read this stuff. They really don't. The way it works in the Court of Criminal Appeals are nine judges, and submission date is on Wednesday. And every case that's been submitted to the court they've accepted, they'll have nine stacks. Mm-hmm. And then after arguments are done on Wednesday, the judges go in and they draw a number out of it. It used to be a hat. I guess maybe they use something different now.
Tambourine.
And if Judge Keller gets stack one, she writes the opinion. And then the other judge, she'll circulate the opinion, and the other judges may or may not read the record. They may just disagree with what she said. They don't know if she read the record or not. As a matter of fact, there was a case out of the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals, and I've mentioned this numerous times to my class at Houston, and they affirmed a murder case and a guy was still alive. No one called it to the motion for rehearing. And the way the opinion began is, we cannot exaggerate the enormity of our error. We have affirmed a murder case, and the named victim in the indictment is alive. And you can't guarantee that these judges read all the record.
Judges do that? Do they have clerks to do that?
Well, they have clerks that do a lot of that. And a lot of times the clerks prepare the opinions. And at one time, up until Judge Clinton is the one that changed a lot of this, was about 15 years ago.
Sam Houston Clinton.
Up until then,
the Court of Criminal Appeals,
you'd have maybe a 3-page opinion, a 4-page opinion was considered mammoth. And when Clinton got on the court, hell, he had opinions that were 10 pages in a footnote. And I told Clinton, because I knew Clinton real well, because I've worked with him from a lot of stuff in Austin. I was in law school, and he's a real lawyer. And I once got him a pencil with an eraser on both ends, and, you know, make a usual big application of this. And Clinton started, he and Marvin Teague used to write these mammoth opinions. Now the ones that write Kathy Cochran does a real thorough job, and she writes a treatise almost every time she writes an opinion. Keller dissents on everything. And the rest of them are kind of in between. Some of them write very scholarly opinions, some of them don't write diddly squat. And it really depends on who draws your case. There's no guarantee that even the judge who wrote the opinion has read the appellate record. She might have relied upon some law clerks to do it, and they didn't read it. And, you know, you've got to be real careful about that. And I promise you, because as many opinions they kick out during a week, There's no way in the world these judges could have read all these records. There's no way. It's impossible, because if you look at a website and them opinions they issue during a week will be enormous, 30 to 40 to 50 opinions. That's a week. And no one's read all that stuff. I mean, that's crazy. And you're lucky. In fact, I think on a lot of writs that are filed, I don't think a lot of judges even see them. I think clerks look at them.
But after they write that opinion and you want to appeal that opinion to the federal court or to a higher court, to take it from district court on up to Court of Criminal Appeals, you're limited to what that opinion is about.
Well, what? You're more limited than that. You've got the only way you can get an appeal to a federal court out of a state court. You've got to have a state court interpreting a federal statute or interpreting a constitutional right. For example, if a state court says they interpret the Fourth Amendment a certain way, you can appeal that. But if it's they interpret their own statutes, you're not going to get an appeal into federal court. For example, if a state opinion cites nothing but Texas law, you'll never get into federal court, ever. The only way you can get into federal court if you're claiming a Sixth Amendment violation for a lawyer being ineffective, and those are just almost impossible to prove, because if you can have any half-assed justification for what you did, they're going to affirm the case. I mean, there's been some real bizarre stuff. As a matter of fact, remember I've mentioned this before, Mike McCormick once claimed when Joe Cannon was sleeping during the murder case, it was good trial strategy to get sympathy from the jury. I mean, I'm serious. And Fifth Circuit finally reversed that case. And so if you have an opinion in state court that's
there was one time they claimed that, well, he didn't sleep in the important parts.
Well, that was a different, that was John Benn, the one that didn't sleep in the important parts. As a matter of fact, thank God John Benn's dead. He was trying a case down in Angleton one time.
Well, how do they know he was either asleep or passed in a coma?
Tell you what he did. He was trying a case down in Angleton one time when the pathologist testified. The pathologist said the guy was stabbed, and John said, and the jury heard him. My God, I didn't know you stabbed him that many times. And so, you know, John was the one that didn't sleep. And probably was better off. In fact, when John tried a case, a judge pointed a lawyer to keep John awake and make sure the record be good, just to make sure it was done right. Because John was hired on a case. And who hired him? I don't think the victim's family hired him to defend the defendant, because that's
oh, my God.
But there's, I mean, like I say, these opinions, you have
Jim,
to...
Jim, if it's all this sloppy, and if it's all this kind of thrown together at the last minute, is this system ever going to work?
Not until we get better judges and limit the number of cases they have to hear. Because you've got to realize there's a volume of opinions that come into a court, and they haven't got the time or the resources to cover it all that well. In fact, Sam Nucci wrote some stuff that was embarrassing. He wrote an opinion once on a DWI case, and they published it, in which he said on a prior felony DWI, on a prior DWI conviction, the jury had to know about it. It was just the opposite. I read that, and I thought, are they all crazy? And they finally withdrew the opinion and wrote it right. And that opinion was written, published, and went through the supposedly view of two other appellate judges, and none of them caught it. And so I guess somebody finally dawned on them. Maybe somebody wrote them a letter saying, you dodo, that you know, the law is just the opposite. And thank God they threw Nucci at him. He was a moron.
He was defeating the Republican.
Yeah, even the Republicans thought he was stupid. Because he's a Republican. Even there, he was too stupid for them.
It's hard to beat an incumbent in a Republican.
Well, especially when he's a former police chief. But Nucci hadn't read a law book in 20 years.
Jim Skelton.
Yes.
Commentary on our court system. You know, the longer we do this, Jim, the closer we get to kind of an expose on the system and its ills.
Well, Ray, for example, this system is geared to kill people. Let me tell you how they gear it. Number one, you don't serve in the jury unless you believe in the death penalty.
Okay, right. You've got to qualify the jury on the basis, can you
kill somebody?
Kill somebody.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if you say you can't, you'll get on the jury. It's not a jury that represents a big cross basis of the population. Number two, the way they do it is really kind of sneaky. They don't ever say, after they found somebody guilty, you want to kill him? They disguise that. They submit questions. Is he going to be a danger in the future? And that way they don't have to think about killing. They just answer the question. Because if they answer the question yes, will he be a danger in the future? Is there anything that mitigates it? No. Then the judge is the one who sentences him to death, not the jury. The word death doesn't appear except in one issue, and that's on the issue of mitigation. So the jury never says we vote death or life. They just answer questions, and that's kind of a convenient way not to think about what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Then the judge can say, well, I have no choice. The law requires me to assess the death penalty because the jury answers these questions yes. And you take cases like this. This is why I'm somewhat defensive of people criticizing lawyers. You take a case like this, what words can you say he's not a future danger?
Yeah.
What words can you say to convince somebody that after he'd tried himself to shoot the very guy who got killed, that he didn't anticipate the guy was going to get killed when he decided to rob the store?
Didn't somebody notice that not only is he talking to God, but God is talking back to him mm-hmm. about these people? Isn't that, I always thought all the believers talk to God regularly, but when God starts talking back, you maybe need to go see a counselor.
It's like Walter Boyd said, you're jealous because you can hear the voices.
Well, Walter hears a lot of voices that we
right,
hear.
Right, I understand. And God gives people some real bad advice. Look what he did with George Bush.
Yeah, right. He told him to run for president.
But, that being crazy is not a defense unless you're so crazy you don't know what you did was wrong. And you can be as crazy as a bedbug mentally, but still be legally sane and responsible for your conduct. And as I said last night, being crazy sometimes works against you, because if you're crazy and the jury thinks you're crazy, it's an inclination to get rid of you.
I used to drop by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals on the weekends and visit an old friend of mine by the name of Charlie Baird.
Oh, yeah. Charlie's a good man.
Because they had good coffee there. That was, of course, before you got corporate coffee all over the universe. I used to go by the Court of Criminal Appeals because they made good coffee. And so we'd go in and drink coffee and talk. And Sam Houston Clinton would come shuffling down the hall.
Looked like a wino, didn't he?
In bib overalls.
Oh, yeah.
And unlaced up boots.
You should have seen his car.
The only
place where you need a tetanus shot to get a ride with him.
Well, he would be working on the weekends, very laboriously working.
Sam and Marvin both did that.
Yeah.
And McCormick never showed up. That's why Charlie ran against him. McCormick ran an antique shop over in Lockhart,
uh-huh.
and he never showed up. Price, Judge Price in Dallas,
yeah.
he still lives in Dallas.
And the court only meets in Austin.
Oh, that's right.
It's not like Fifth Circuit. They meet all over the place.
But no, only in Austin. And he'll drive down for the arguments and haul his happy ass back to Dallas.
And the state of the court is not good now.
It's improved a little bit. Charlie Baird got replaced by Price, but Price has been pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Cochran's been a real help. She's been good. Johnson has been good. And then we got the rest of them consist of former DAs who worked in the briefing section of the appellate division, so you can imagine they're Kellers or clone of Kellers. That's the other problem.
And do you take in consideration who is actually going to look at the briefs when you write them?
Absolutely, because if you happen to get one of those rednecks, you're in trouble. Yeah.
Jim Skelton giving wisdom. Tell your friends to go to the archive of executionwatch.org and listen to tonight's show. We had a very special amount of sidebar information from Jim Skelton, and it's good to get him in a talkative mood for that. We couldn't do this at all if it weren't for our technical wizard, Otis McClay, who is in the other room putting the transistors together. The theme music for the show is from Victoria Panetti. Our media contact and expert senior producer is Elizabeth Stein. And she got in touch with Dennis Longmire, David Atwood, and special guest Representative Harold Dutton. I am Ray Hill, thanking Jim Skelton and saying good night for Execution Watch. You're listening to KPFT HD2 channel.